Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, a consumer rights group accuses gaming companies of manipulative practices, tricking children into spending money on in-game tokens.
We have examples where parents were surprised basically at the end of the month receiving a bill, which is quite enormous because in one or two clicks you can make immediate payments.
We'll also be in Malawi, where farmers are turning overripe bananas that would otherwise go to waste into a surprising new product.
As they say almost goes, if life gives you overripe bananas, make wine.
And we'll reflect on the economic legacy of the late Peruvian president, Alberto Fujimori. That's all coming up, but we're going to start in China because stock markets there have fallen to their lowest point in well over 5 years. The benchmark CSI 300 index has dropped 14% since May alone and is heading for its fourth straight year of losses. This week, the European Chamber of Commerce in Beijing published a detailed report on the problems facing the world's second biggest economy. 71% of the chamber's members say profit margins in China are now equal to or below the global average, and 44% are pessimistic about future profitability. The head of the chamber, Jens Eskeland, spoke to me from Beijing.
The sentiment amongst European companies that the economy is not going to turn around in any near future is becoming more entrenched. Expectations have been lowered. And what is happening now and what makes it so urgent that the Chinese government begins to do something is that European companies are actually beginning to act on these changed expectations.
When they're acting, what are they doing?
One thing that we see very clearly now is that investments that were previously being planned for China are beginning to move abroad. We are seeing FDI levels coming into China being at a very, very low level that were actually negative last quarter. We're beginning to see that companies are repatriating to a larger extent their earnings in China. And really, what we are seeing is that China is no longer quite the most attractive location for additional investments. We're beginning to see other countries in the region becoming, in relative terms, more attractive compared to China.
Yeah, those FDI figures, the foreign direct investment figures, pretty worrying for China. They've fallen around 30% in the first 7 months of this year compared to last year. You've set out various recommendations in this report, what you think the Chinese government should be doing. Can you tell us what they are?
At the very high end of recommendation, at the very macro level, it would be to ensure that there is a better balance between supply and demand. What we have seen is that there's been a rather sluggish rebound on the demand side, and investment allocation of resources into manufacturing continue to outpace demand growth. And that's one of those things that leads to overcapacity. We can see that profits are eroding, and actually we have an all-time low in terms of companies expecting, being optimistic about the future profits for the next 2 years. It's down to 15%. So that is at the very, very high level.
And yet the Chinese government has taken some measures recently. For example, they've opened up the hospital sector to foreign investment just recently. So do you feel as though they are aware of these problems and they're willing to take the measures they need to rectify them?
We have seen a number of measures. And 1 year ago, on the 13th of August, the State Council released the so-called 24 measures. There's a lot of good stuff in that. And if implemented in a substantial and meaningful way, we do believe that those would indeed improve the conditions for companies on the ground. What we have seen, however, is that some of the things that would really move the needle for European companies have not yet been addressed substantially. One area is access to public procurement, and in China in particular, public procurement is a very big chunk of the economy.
There seems to be a bit of a contradiction here, because on the one hand, the European Union is saying that the Chinese economy is not doing well, it's becoming a difficult place to do business. On the other hand, the EU is putting tariffs in place because they say that Chinese companies are too competitive.
Some of it has to do with the situation I described before, where we see the growth in manufacturing output growing much faster than what the domestic market can absorb. And that means several things. One is that China needs to export a lot more in order to absorb the excess production. Another one is that there is a very significant pressure on prices. We have seen now very extraordinarily 23 consecutive months of producer price deflation. And that means that goods are getting progressively cheaper. And very often we see that it's not simply because companies are becoming more effective. It is also about sometimes that these companies are being helped, supported to continue production by many different means that, you know, in a real market economy would perhaps not be able to continue.
Jens Esklund there, the head of the European Chamber of Commerce in Beijing. Well, I'm joined by Emma Wall, head of investment analysis and research at Hargreaves Lansdown. And Emma, this is all about domestic demand in China, isn't it, really? I mean, Chinese companies still competitive in Europe and the United States, but it's domestic demand that's the problem.
There's a few problems when it comes to the Chinese stock market. And today, if you just look across the boards, it's very apparent because the rest of the world is up today. It's a sea of green. But then you look at the Shanghai Composite and it's down. And it's been down really this current route since around May. But it's been a multi-year view that has the Chinese stock market and indeed the Chinese economy has struggled with because they are interlinked. I mean, often in developed markets, we say actually a stock market can do well regardless of the economic outlook. But with emerging markets such as China, they're much more entwined. And it is very much a view on domestic consumption, on the property market, and where growth is going to come from in the future for China, as well as stock-specific issues around the engagement from the government in certain sectors, which are hampering their outlook.
Okay, well, let's move over to the EU itself, because the European Central Bank has been meeting today and has tweaked interest rates. Let's listen to the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde.
The Governing Council today decided to lower the deposit facility rate by 25 basis points. We are determined to ensure that inflation returns to our 2% medium-term target in a timely manner. We will keep policy rates sufficiently restrictive for as long as necessary to achieve the same.
And Emma, I guess you can read this as a glass half full or empty situation, isn't it? It could be taken as a sign that inflation has been beaten, or it could be taken as a sign that the EU economy is very sluggish and needs a bit of a boost from lower interest rates.
Absolutely. And I think actually the forecasting from here is very interesting too, because it's more of the same, as you say. So today's cut of 25 basis points was very much expected. The markets are priced in. What they're continuing to price in, however, is at least one more cut this calendar year and perhaps another. And that tracks what the ECB are saying themselves in terms of both their inflation outlook from not just this year, but next year and the year beyond, and their growth outlook. So yes, inflation is falling, but so is the growth that those European countries are generating. And so therefore, as you say, the central bank is taking that decision not just because of the upside of inflation falling, but also because of this growth outlook. It should be said, though, that markets have reacted positively, and across Europe and indeed the UK, stock markets are up today on the news.
That EU growth rate is still looking fairly feeble. The ECB has actually trimmed its rate down to 0.8% for this year, down from 0.9%, and it's also lowered its estimate for 2025 as well. And looking ahead, the Fed meeting next week, a 25 basis point cut baked in now?
Yes, but it's not as clear cut actually as they had hoped it would have been by now. You know, all of these central banks are very data led. And actually, the mixed employment figures that came out last week from the US has really actually taken the edge of what we thought was going to be a very definitive, yes, rates are going to be cut. And that's because although new job creation was down, actually, so was unemployment. So mixed employment data last week has made it more of a mixed bag, but we do think they will cut.
Emma, thanks for joining us. We'll take a look to see what the Fed does next week. Now to Boeing. Workers at Boeing will vote later on Thursday on a crucial pay offer from the company. Boeing is offering them a 25% pay rise over the next 4 years. If unionised workers reject the offer, it could spark a strike as early as Friday. The BBC's international business correspondent, Theo Leggett, explains.
There's a great deal at stake here, Gideon, for 33,000 unionised workers in Washington State, mainly at Boeing's Renton factory, where it makes the 737, and at its Everett factory, where it makes the 777, and also some workers as well in Portland, Oregon, which makes parts for civilian aircraft and drones as well. What they're voting on is a four-year new contract that has been negotiated between the IAM, the union, and Boeing. But the essential point that it makes is it will increase pay across the board by about 25% over 4 years. It includes extra benefits like reduced mandatory overtime, better health benefits, a slightly better retirement program. And Boeing and the union leadership seem very pleased with this. But it has to be voted on by Boeing workers. If they approve it, it'll go ahead. If they reject it, they will also vote on whether or not to take strike action. And if two-thirds of those balloted vote for strike action, then a strike could begin at Boeing from midnight Thursday into Friday Pacific time.
So as you say, Theo, just a few hours to go before that crucial union vote, do we get any sense of how likely it is to be approved?
So although the way the voting works, with a two-thirds majority needed for a strike, that seems to put Boeing in the pound seat, seems to suggest that this contract will be approved, it is by no means a done deal. The union leadership have recommended this, but there have been demonstrations over the past week, particularly outside Boeing's Everett plant, by a large number of workers who are clearly angry, some of them suggesting even that they've been sold out by the union leadership. There is antipathy between Boeing's workers and Boeing management that is not new. It goes back years. It goes back to a time when Boeing went into negotiations like these on previous contracts in a position of strength and effectively ratcheted down the terms and conditions of workers, including taking away their guaranteed pension plans, because it could threaten them with taking production out of Washington State and to other areas of the country where there would be much less unionization. And that's why, incidentally, I think that one of the items that Boeing's put in this proposal is the suggestion that if it starts building a new aircraft design within the next 4 years, that new aircraft would be built in Washington State. But whether the workforce are impressed by that, whether they feel they can trust management, that's likely to be key.
Theo Leggett there, and we'll be following that Boeing vote on our programmes later on today.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now to the world of video games. The sound there of some game shooting. How many of you either play video games or have children who do? And if you do, how much are you or they spending on in-game virtual currencies or tokens? A consumer rights group here in Europe says games companies like Activision Blizzard and Electronic Arts should come clean about what these tokens actually are. They should make clear that they're linked to real money. The European Consumer Group, or BEUC, has lodged a complaint today with the European Commission, urging it to take action. I've been speaking to the group's senior legal officer, Stephen Berger.
We are looking into the practices of several major game developers, which are basically implementing what we call the premium in-game currency. So basically a currency that you buy with real money in video games, then to spend into the video games itself, buying digital contents like a skin or a loot boxes. The problem that we see, and it's a major one, is that under the legislation, you need to be informed about the real price of what you're about to buy. And the problem is that all the video games we target are only giving you the price in tokens, which is non-compliant with every basic consumer law on price information. And this is really widespread. the video games are playing in the whole EU, of course, but also worldwide. So similar problems may happen, of course, in the US.
And I guess in many cases, it's the children who are playing the video games, but it's often their parents who are footing the bill.
Exactly. And we have a couple of examples where parents were surprised, basically, at the end of the month, receiving a bill, which is quite enormous, because in one or two clicks, you can make immediate payments, which in our assessment should not be the case. This should be forbidden as a matter of professional diligence. It's a sectorial issue, which even goes beyond the video game. You can have now these kind of tokens and coins available on TikTok, on Twitch, even Amazon with Amazon Coins are developing that. So it's really widespread. The video game industry, it's more in terms of revenue than the cinema and the music combined. So it's really huge. It's not a niche market anymore. And the thing is that more and more of these revenue trends are coming from in-game purchases, which most of the time are made with this kind of currency.
And how widespread is this? How many children in Europe play video games? And how many of them play video games that use these in-game tokens?
Well, according to the figures even published by the European Commission, 84% of the children between 11 and 14 are basically playing video games almost on a daily basis. Of course, all the practices that we share in our report impact all consumers, but also children, which are massively present there. You should have, as a professional, an extra diligence and take really the steps to make sure that consumers really understand what they are about to spend.
And you've used some quite strong language in this complaint, saying it's deceptive, it's manipulative, that these companies are purposefully tricking consumers. Strong language, but you might not like this. Is it actually a breach of EU rules?
It is clearly, in our assessment, a breach of EU rules. One of them is basically pre-contractual information, meaning that before you buy, and this is valid for every type of contract, including in video games, you need to be informed about the full price in real currency, not in virtual currency that you have. And all the video games are basically breaching this obligation. In our assessment, it should be as simple as if you buy a bottle of water in a shop when you buy something into a video game. For now, in certain video games, you have what they call a conversion rate. So basically a possibility for you to calculate what you will spend into the video games buying something. But it's meaningless and you should not have to rely on a calculator every time you want to do something or buy something. You should have a clear and straightforward information, especially because you have a lot of children playing there.
And have you spoken to the companies involved about this problem?
We informed them that an action was coming, but it was not a dialogue, let's say, with them. Now the complaints are in the hands of the authorities.
And to sum up, what would you like to see the European Commission do about this?
The first thing that we ask is to the different consumer protection authorities, definitely to ensure a fair gaming environment for consumers, and especially the children, which are really present there. Ensure that you know exactly the price that you're about to pay. So every in-game purchase should be displayed in real currency. That's the main demand that we have.
Stephen Berger there from the European Consumer Group. Well, almost all of the companies named in that report have responded to the BBC. Video Games Europe, whose members include Epic Games, Roblox, Activision, Blizzard, Electronic Arts, Supercell and Ubisoft, said the purchase of in-game currencies is a well-established practice and well understood by players. It said, our members always respect European consumer laws in how they offer their purchases. To Peru now, because the former president, Alberto Fujimori, has died at the age of 86. Loved by some, especially in Peru's poorer communities, he was credited by some for transforming the economy with what's become known as Fujinomics. These were the scenes last night outside his home as his coffin was carried out. You can hear the mourners gathering there, some of them praying. Fujimori was credited with beating the Maoist insurgency group, the Shining Path, and for opening up Peru's economy. But his legacy was tainted after he was also convicted for corruption, abuse of power, and for being behind two death squad massacres in the early 1990s. A few years ago, from his hospital bed, Fujimori asked for forgiveness.
Por otro lado, que he defraudado también a otros compatriotas.
Well, to discuss all of this, I'm joined by Peruvian academic Julio Carrion, who now teaches on Latin American politics at the University of Delaware. Julio, welcome to the program. Before we get to Fujinomics, just give us an idea of the Peru that Alberto Fujimori inherited when he took over in 1990 and the economic mess that it was in.
Oh, yeah. It was a mess, not only in economic terms, but also in political terms. Peru, when Fujimori was elected in 1990, was in the midst of a hyperinflationary period, in the midst of a dramatic domestic conflict that has caused thousands of people killed by the brutality of both Shining Path and the ill-advised tactics of the military. And it was a general sense of despair when Fujimori was elected. And the reason, one of the reasons why Peruvians actually voted for him was because they had no hope or faith in the parties that preceded him. And so, yeah, it was a bad moment. And probably the only reason why he was elected was because his main contender, Mario Vargas Llosa, well-known novelist, was basically offering a harsh medicine as a way to fix Peru's problems. The irony, of course, is that Fujimori defeated Mario Vargas Llosa, and he, Fujimori, ended up applying the very economic policy that Mario Vargas Llosa was advocating on the campaign trail. Right.
And so what did Alberto Fujimori do to solve those problems, and particularly the economic problems?
Well, here it's important that we remember that it was a mixed legacy. So there were significant victories and accomplishments in his economic policy, but there were also some shortcomings. Clearly, the most important victory was defeating hyperinflation and keeping inflation under control. He adopted one of the harshest stabilization programs in Latin America. He was able to do it because as president, he had significant presidential powers. He pretty much enacted the economic program by decree. And it was a typical application of the shock therapy. And it was effective in controlling inflation, which by 1990 has reached over 7,000 per year. So it was a significant victory when he kept that under control. And Peruvians credited with him, right? I mean, inflation, as you know, as your listeners know, is not only a economic phenomenon, but it's also a psychological problem because people have no ability to plan for the near future. And so once inflation is under control, people at least regain a sense of control. They can plan. And that pay Fujimori significant political dividends. Mm.
And Peru, over the last 20 years or so, since the beginning of the 21st century, has been one of Latin America's economic success stories, relatively stable, a growth rate of around 5%. To what extent do you think Fujimori can claim credit for laying the foundations for that economic growth? Some of his supporters say that he deserves that credit. Do you think that's true?
I think he deserves partial credit. I think the most important accomplishments in that regard was that he established a economic governance that allowed Peru to keep deficits under control and to curtail expenditure during election times. And he also fostered a very professional Ministry of Finance. So to the extent that the economic governance was in place, Peru was in a position to take advantage of the commodity boom that came after he left office.
And you lived in Peru during that time, didn't you? Paint us a picture of the changes that we're seeing. We're seeing Mourners crying today. Why was he so loved?
It's interesting because at the time, in the 1990s, my father was a retiree. He was living on a fixed income. He was feeling the consequences of hyperinflation because obviously his income was, getting shorter and shorter every month. But the shock therapy really put him and many families in his condition that were living on fixed earning in a dramatic situation because all of a sudden prices were liberalized and they just shot through the roof and the incomes didn't catch up. So one segment of the population suffered significantly by the adjustment, and that's why poverty rates increase in a couple of years after the implementation of those programs.
Right.
On the other hand, the control of hyperinflation had a significant benefit for many families, because even if they have little, they could plan how to spend that little income.
Julio, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on the program. Julio Carrion from the University of Delaware. We're going to end today's program in Africa, because in northern Malawi, extreme weather patterns are pushing farmers to experiment with new ways to use their harvest. Some of them are now turning overripe bananas that would otherwise go to waste into a surprising new product. Anne Okumu reports from Karonga.
Extreme weather events in Karonga district, northern Malawi, have become more frequent. Farmers here face a challenging mix of harsh heat and intense rain. Emily relocated her farm from the shores of Lake Malawi to higher grounds to protect her land from flooding. But now, searing temperatures have made farming nearly impossible.
Some of the bananas fell off their branches. Some you can't even see where we planted. Down at the old farm, our challenge was loads of water from the lake. Up here, we have way too much heat from the sun. All this makes our bananas ripen very fast and go to waste.
So instead of throwing away overripe bananas, Emily and her colleagues have put them to better use. They use overripe bananas to make wine. Bananas are selected, peeled, sweetened and doused in yeast and lemons to preserve taste. They are then fermented to make wine. Tennyson Gondwe is the CEO of Comsip Cooperative Union, which has been helping women venture into this business.
There was quite a lot of problems for the farmers to transition from banana as a subsistence crop to winemaking. To maintain quality and taste of the banana wine, that's why we are saying we have invested very much in capacity building to train them on how to have quality production and also to maintain the taste. That's why we also had our colleagues in the Malawi Bureau of Standards, which is trying to certify. We have also assisted them with the equipment for them to measure the quality and the alcoholic content of the banana wine.
Vineyards that rely on stable climates are threatened by the unpredictability of climate change. So, could bananas replace grapes for winemaking? What is for sure now is that banana wine has proved a success in neighboring markets in Tanzania and Rwanda. But what about here in Malawi? Back at the farm, winemakers have a taste of their labor.
This is very sweet wine. You need to be seated to enjoy the flavors.
Adapting to climate change is a tough challenge for farmers around the world. But as the farming community in this part of Malawi can testify, there can be alternative solutions. As the say almost goes, if life gives you overripe bananas, make wine.
Make wine indeed. And it is astonishing, isn't it, the lengths that human beings will go to make wine and other alcoholic drinks from pretty much anything, from grapes, from potatoes, from maize, from barley. I wonder if there's any fruit that you can't use to make wine. Anne Okumu reporting there from Malawi. That's just about the end of this edition of World Business Report. Do join us for our later programmes on World Business Report and on Business Matters. Rahul Tandon, my colleague, will be in the chair for those programmes, and I'm no doubt that he will be talking about that crucial vote at Boeing, where they will decide whether they'll be going on strike. But for now, that's all from me, Gideon Long.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the global investigations podcast from the BBC.